Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine a time in America. Everything felt new, uncertain, but also just absolutely bursting with potential. We're talking about the first half of the 19th century, those really pivotal decades leading right up to the U.S. Civil War. This wasn't a period of slow, quiet growth. It was, well, a whirlwind, expansion, change. It fundamentally reshaped the young nation.
That's right. And for those maybe, less familiar with this era, picture it as the nation's energetic, sometimes kind of awkward adolescence.
Good way to put it.
I mean, you had the Louisiana Purchase just dramatically expanding the borders, opening up vast new territories, really stretching the map.
Huge expansion.
Then the War of 1812, despite, well, struggles like the burning of Washington, D.C., it ultimately proved the U.S. was a rising global power, solidified its place.
Right, it showed they could stand up.
Exactly. And you also had incredible things like the Erie Canal opening up, connecting the Great Lakes to the Atlantic, just vastly speeding up commerce and settlement.
Transforming trade.
The future really looked west. There was this palpable sense of manifest destiny, this belief, in a divinely ordained right to expand. It was shaping the whole national psyche.
But here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Even with all this incredible westward push and growth, the center of political power, it stayed firmly rooted in the East, specifically Washington, D.C.
Still very much an Eastern establishment controlling things, yeah.
And into this fast-changing yet still kind of centrally controlled landscape stepped a genuine force of nature, Andrew Jackson.
Ah, Jackson. His rise to the presidency, it was propelled by this new wave of democratic ideals, championing the common man.
Yeah, very different style.
And his policies, often forceful, definitely polarizing at times, they fundamentally altered the political scene. He challenged established norms, institutions like the National Bank.
Claiming it was aristocratic, right?
Exactly, an aristocratic tool. And this whole dynamic, disruptive environment created, well, both necessary alliances and quite often really unpredictable partnerships.
It forced people together.
It forced rival factions to come together, yeah, even if sometimes it was just to oppose him.
And today we're diving deep into one of the most famous of these pairings, or maybe, like you said, more like a competitive constellation of giants known as the Great Triumvirate.
That's the one.
These three men, absolute titans of the U.S. Senate, they dominated American politics for decades. They were navigating these treacherous waters of a nation grappling with its identity and, most critically, the increasingly explosive issue of slavery.
Yeah, slavery was the shadow looming over everything.
So today, our goal is to try and understand how these leaders, despite their huge personal ambitions and their really deep regional loyalties, somehow managed to forge compromises that, for a time at least, held the Union together.
And we've sifted through a really fascinating collection of sources for this deep dive, historical articles, detailed biographies of these remarkable figures.
Good stuff.
We'll explore their unique leadership styles, how fiercely they fought for their regions, their complex, often very difficult relationship with compromise.
Which is key.
Absolutely. Their relentless drive for the presidency, and yes, their collective and often pretty intense dislike of Andrew Jackson.
Okay, so where do we start?
Let's start with a look at the formidable, godlike Daniel Webster.
All right, Daniel Webster. Godlike Daniel, that nickname came from his incredible public speaking, right? But he was also known as Black Dan. Why the contrast?
Well, Black Dan referred partly to his dark features, but later, maybe more pointedly, to his complicated, some might say darker political compromises, especially towards the end.
Okay, so tell us about his background. What made his oratory so legendary?
Webster was born in a two-room log cabin, rural New Hampshire, 1782, a genuinely hardscrabble life, second youngest of 10 kids.
Wow, humble beginnings.
Very. And what's fascinating is that initially he had this deep, almost crippling fear of public speaking. So bad he actually dropped out of Phillips Exeter Academy because of it.
No kidding, the great orator.
I know, right? But he was utterly determined to overcome it. By 18, at Dartmouth College, he'd completely transformed, became a premier orator, known for an almost photographic memory.
Amazing turnaround.
His Hanover speech, July 4th, 1800, he glorified Washington, passionately praised the Union. It really foreshadowed his entire career. That theme of Union was there from the start.
So he turned this fear into an incredible strength. The sources describe his voice like an African lion and his gaze like a thunderstorm in July. Sounds intense.
Absolutely. He could genuinely captivate an audience. Crowds were said to have literally swooned, been reduced to tears.
Wow.
But he wasn't just a powerful speaker. He was a consummate lawyer, argued over 150 cases before the Supreme Court, winning about half.
That's impressive.
Very. And his arguments, particularly in huge landmark cases like Dartmouth College v. Woodward in 1819.
Right, the one about college charters and contracts.
Exactly. Establishing property rights for private institutions, a really big deal for business growth. And McCulloch v. Maryland, also 1819.
The National Bank case.
Yes. Affirming Congress's power to establish a national bank. Crucial for federal authority over states. These cases truly helped shape American constitutional law, and they profoundly influenced Chief Justice John Marshall.
So a powerful legal mind shaping the country alongside his political career, how did his regional loyalties, New England, and his national ambitions play out?
Well, initially he represented New Hampshire in Congress as a Federalist, and he famously opposed the War of 1812.
Why?
He warned its negative impact on trade could actually cause New England to secede from the still fragile Union. Shows his early concern for holding things together, even then.
Interesting.
After the Federalist Party collapsed, he moved to Boston, became a Whig, a party explicitly formed to oppose Jackson's Democrats.
Right, the anti-Jackson party.
Exactly. His true ambition, though, was always the presidency. But it consistently eluded him.
Never quite made it.
Never. He was offered the vice presidency twice, under William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor. But he famously refused. Said he didn't propose to be buried until I am really dead.
Oh, wow. Ironic, right?
Deeply ironic.
Uh-huh.
Both Harrison and Taylor died in office. He would have become president if he'd accepted either time.
Incredible. So he was known as the guardian of the nation, preserver of the Union. How did he actually engage in compromise, especially on slavery, the toughest issue?
His commitment to the Union was, well, paramount, above almost everything else. In his famous second reply to Hayne in 1830, he declared, "Liberty and Union, now and forever, one and inseparable."
Yeah.
That was his mantra.
Powerful words.
While he privately condemned slavery, even apparently gave money to enslaved people to buy their freedom, his biggest, most defining act of compromise came with the Compromise of 1850.
Okay, the big one near the end of his career.
Yes. Despite his lifelong personal abhorrence of slavery, he supported this compromise, which included that deeply controversial Strengthened Fugitive Slave Act.
Requiring the return of escaped enslaved people, even in free states.
Exactly. He saw it, quite pragmatically perhaps, as a necessary evil. The only way, in his view, to keep the nation from fracturing right then and there, he believed the Union's survival outweighed even that profound moral cost.
That decision, supporting the Fugitive Slave Act, it feels like such a moral tightrope walk.
Yeah.
Was there any alternative path he might have seen, or is that just the only lever left?
That's a powerful question. And yeah, historians still debate it intensely. From the sources, it really appears he genuinely believed it was the only way to avoid immediate secession by the Southern states.
He thought the threat was that real.
He saw the stakes as existential, the nation on the brink. So perhaps not a better path in his mind, but certainly a tragic and, for him, politically devastating necessity at that moment.
And that decision definitely cost him dearly, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. His 7th of March speech in 1850, where he urged abolitionists to be patient, argued for the compromise, apparently slammed into New England with the force of a hurricane.
Strong reaction.
Abolitionists like John Greenleaf Whittier, Ralph Waldo Emerson, they harshly condemned him. Emerson famously said, "Liberty, liberty, foo. Let Mr. Webster, for decency's sake, shut his lips for once and forever on this word."
Ouch, that's brutal.
His political base in the North was essentially ruined. He resigned from the Senate shortly after. And although he served a second term as Secretary of State, enforcing that fugitive slave law by sending federal troops to Boston, it just further destroyed his reputation up North.
So sad, in a way.
He died in 1852, apparently a bitter man. But his final words were reportedly, "I still live." Kind of underscores his enduring legacy as a defender of the Union, even if his methods were deeply controversial.
Okay, so Webster, from the North, prioritizing the Union above almost all else, but just as fiercely advocating for his region and often directly opposing Webster's vision was John C. Calhoun.
Ah, Calhoun, the champion of Southern interests.
Let's dive into what drove him. What was his background?
Calhoun, born in South Carolina, also 1782, same year as Webster, interestingly. He was from a prominent slaveholding family, and that upbringing just deeply shaped his views on states' rights in Southern society.
So a very different starting point from Webster's log cabin.
Very different. Highly educated, Yale, Litchfield Law School. And from early on, a powerful voice. In the South Carolina legislature, he chaired a committee that made South Carolina the first state to eliminate property qualifications for voting, granting universal white male suffrage.
Interesting. An early Democratic move, but with that crucial qualifier.
Exactly. Which foreshadows the contradictions. The sources call him the Young Hercules during the War of 1812.
Why Hercules?
He was a leading war hawk in the House, one of those pushing hard for war with Britain. He distinguished himself early on actually supporting a national bank and internal improvements initially.
Which seems counterintuitive given his later stance.
It does, yeah. Shows how views could evolve or shift based on perceived regional needs. He served as James Monroe's Secretary of War, reorganized the armed forces, even moved to censure Andrew Jackson for invading Spanish Florida.
Clashing with Jackson even back then?
Oh, yeah. He also supported the Missouri Compromise initially and the Monroe Doctrine. His ambition for the presidency was crystal clear. Elected vice president twice.
Under Adders and Jackson, that's almost unheard of.
It really is. An incredible feat.
But his relationship with Jackson, serving as his VP, it wasn't smooth sailing, was it? That divergence feels key.
Absolutely critical. It became famously, publicly clear at the Jefferson Day Dinner in 1829. Remember Jackson's toast, our federal union, it must be preserved.
Right. And Calhoun's response.
Calhoun immediately countered, our federal union next to our liberties the most dear. May we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states.
Wow, laying it right out there.
Totally. That exchange just perfectly highlighted the core conflict. Jackson's focus on federal power versus Calhoun's increasingly fervent defense of state sovereignty, especially for Southern interests.
That really crystallizes the tension, and this leads directly to his big idea, his theory of nullification.
Indeed. Calhoun anonymously authored the South Carolina Exposition and Protest in 1828. This articulated his theory that an individual state could declare a federal law like the Tariff of Abominations.
Which Southerners hated, saw as unfair.
Exactly. They saw it as benefiting only Northern industries at their expense. Calhoun argued a state could declare such a law unconstitutional and null and void within its own borders.
A radical idea.
Hugely radical. He even saw secession as a justifiable next step if nullification failed. This led directly to the nullification crisis. South Carolina adopted an ordinance of nullification.
And Jackson's response?
Jackson, never one to back down, responded forcefully, requested a force bill from Congress to authorize sending troops to South Carolina to collect the tariff.
Wow, high stakes.
Extremely. Calhoun ultimately resigned as vice president in December 1832. It's also worth noting there was a social dimension to the Peggy Eaton affair, a scandal involving cabinet wives snubbing Peggy Eaton, which Calhoun's wife Floride was central to, also badly damaged his relationship with Jackson.
Right, the social drama feeding the political fire. And what about his stance on slavery itself?
Calhoun became an ardent, almost fanatical defender of slavery. In 1837, he delivered that infamous speech declaring slavery not an evil, but a positive good.
A positive good. How did he justify that?
He claimed it civilized the African race, brought them Christianity, and was implicitly legal under the Constitution. He sought to protect slave owners' rights through really radical concepts like concurrent majority.
What was that exactly?
It was a proposed system where a minority interest, like the Southern states, could effectively veto federal legislation they opposed. It fundamentally challenged the whole principle of majority rule. He even floated the idea of a dual presidency, one president for the North, one for the South.
That sounds completely unworkable.
It shows how far he was willing to go to protect Southern interests, specifically slavery. This unwavering, uncompromising support obviously caused him broader national support as abolitionism grew in the North. He became the symbol of Southern extremism for many.
So a fierce advocate for his region and its peculiar institution, even pushing towards secession if needed. It's such a stark contrast to Webster's focus on union.
Precisely. He eventually returned to the Senate, serving alongside Webster and Clay in the triumvirate. He notably opposed the Mexican-American War, fearing it would reopen the slavery expansion debate, which it did.
And the Wilmot Proviso.
Right. He fought against the Wilmot Proviso, which aimed to ban slavery in any territory won from Mexico. His final Senate speech, read by a colleague because he was too ill consumption, probably tuberculosis.
How poignant.
It hauntingly called for a peaceful separation of states if a just settlement couldn't be reached on the issues dividing North and South. He died March 31st, 1850, shortly after that speech. Just months before the Compromise of 1850 was enacted, the very compromise designed to prevent the separation he foresaw.
Wow. Okay, finally, let's turn to Henry Clay, arguably the most famous of the three for his skill in brokering deals. the great compromiser, the star of the West.
That's him. Henry Clay, born in Virginia, 1777, also came from relatively humble beginnings, though maybe not quite Webster's log cabin.
Okay.
He taught himself law, moved to Kentucky, and quickly gained a reputation as a highly skilled attorney and a really captivating public speaker.
Another great orator. Seems to be a theme.
Definitely a prerequisite for power back then. He was known for his relentless drive, described as a young man on the make. Worked hard, but also played hard. Enjoyed cards, gambling, bourbon. Earned him the nickname Prince Hal.
Prince Hal, like Shakespeare's character, a bit of a rogue.
A bit, yeah. Charismatic, maybe a little reckless, but incredibly ambitious. He married Lucretia Hart, had 11 children, but politics remained absolutely paramount for him.
A true self-made man who soared through the political ranks, becoming Speaker of the House almost immediately.
That's incredible.
Oh.
What did that signify about him? It really showed his extraordinary knack for building coalitions, commanding respect very quickly, even across party lines early on. The sources point to his persuasive power, his mastery of legislative rules, his strategic mind.
Skills honed early.
Definitely. Elected to the Kentucky legislature, brief terms in the Senate, then boom, Speaker of the House in 1811, a role he held off and on for much of his career.
And like Calhoun, he was a war hawk.
A leading war hawk, yes, pushing hard for the War of 1812.
Mm.
And then, interestingly, he helped negotiate the Treaty of Ghent that ended it.
From pushing for war to negotiating peace. Versatile.
Very. He was also the architect of his American system. This was his big economic vision.
Right. Involving tariffs, a national bank.
Exactly. High protective tariffs to boost American industry, a strong national bank for stable currency and credit, and government-funded internal improvements. Roads, canals, infrastructure.
Why was that so important to him?
He saw these as vital for national unity, tying the different regions together economically. Also crucial for prosperity, especially for the development of the expanding West, his region.
And he earned that great compromiser nickname early on, didn't he?
He did. His skill at forging compromise became his trademark. He was absolutely instrumental in crafting the Missouri Compromise of 1820.
The one that brought in Maine as free, Missouri as slave?
Yes, and drew that 36-degree, 30-R latitude line, banning slavery north of it, except for Missouri. It was a really complex balancing act to temporarily quiet the storm over slavery's expansion.
A temporary fix.
As most compromises on slavery proved to be, Clay himself later said, "The true friend to his country aims to extinguish or allay prejudices." He even argued, "Life itself is but a compromise. All legislation, all government, all society is formed upon the principle of mutual concession." That was his philosophy.
Yet despite this incredible skill and prominence, the presidency always eluded him. He seems like the perennial runner-up.
It was one of the great tragedies of his career, really. Ran 5 times, never won.
Why do you think that was?
Well, his support for John Quincy Adams in the 1824 election, the one decided by the House, led to that enduring corrupt bargain accusation.
Ah, when Adams then appointed Clay Secretary of State.
Exactly. Jackson's supporters screamed foul play, claiming Clay traded his influence as Speaker for the cabinet post. Historians mostly dismiss it now, but it haunted his career.
Mud sticks, I guess.
It really did. He later became a fierce opponent of Andrew Jackson, leading the National Republicans, which morphed into the Whigs the party basically formed to challenge King Andrew I.
So another intense rivalry with Jackson.
Oh, yes. He clashed with Jackson over the Second Bank of the U.S., which Jackson destroyed, and over federal funding for projects like the Maysville Road Bill in Kentucky, which Jackson vetoed, arguing it only benefited one state.
Yet even with these rivalries and setbacks, he still stepped up when the Union felt like it was really at stake.
He absolutely did. That's his defining legacy, perhaps. When South Carolina threatened nullification over the tariffs, based on Calhoun's theory.
The crisis we talked about earlier.
Right. Clay stepped into the breach, became the great pacificator. He worked tirelessly behind the scenes, crafting the Compromise Tariff of 1833.
What did that do?
It gradually lowered the tariff rates over several years. Crucially, he secured support from both Calhoun, who needed a way out for South Carolina, and Northern manufacturers. It averted a potential military clash.
Masterful negotiation.
Truly. And his final major legislative effort was, of course, the Compromise of 1850.
Working alongside Webster on that one?
Yes, though Clay initially proposed it as one big omnibus bill with 8 parts admitting California free popular sovereignty in Utah-New Mexico territories, the tougher Fugitive Slave Act.
That omnibus bill failed, though, right?
It did initially. Too many conflicting parts for everyone to swallow at once. But then Senator Stephen Douglas cleverly broke it down and pushed the individual components through separately. Still, Clay laid the groundwork. It delayed the Civil War by another decade.
So what was his personal stance on slavery, given he owned enslaved people himself but crafted these compromises?
Clay was considered a moderate on slavery, certainly compared to Calhoun. He advocated for gradual manumission, freeing enslaved people over time, and helped found the American Colonization Society.
The group that promoted sending freed slaves to Africa.
Yes, a controversial idea even then, but seen by some moderates as a potential, albeit flawed, solution. He said, "I am no friend of slavery. Every pulsation of mine beats high and strong in the cause of civil liberty."
But there's usually a but.
There is, he added, "but I prefer the liberty of my own country to that of other people, and the liberty of my own race to that of any other race." So, a clear hierarchy in his view. His compromises, aimed at union, undeniably prolonged slavery.
A complex legacy.
Very. He died in 1852, still a senator.
Yeah.
First person ever to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Abraham Lincoln, who deeply admired Clay, gave a eulogy calling him his beau ideal of a statesman.
High praise from Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So we've looked at Webster, Calhoun, and Clay, three incredibly ambitious, articulate, often deeply flawed men, representing such different regional interests, north, south, west.
And their careers were just marked by these intense rivalries, but also strategic alliances, especially, as we saw, in their shared opposition to Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
His presidency really shaped so much of their maneuvering.
Masters of oratory. Setting the national agenda with their words. Yet, despite all that brilliance and influence, the ultimate prize the presidency eluded all three.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
What's truly compelling here, I think, is how their huge personal ambitions, their deep commitment to their regions, and their shared desire to stop the nation from collapsing just constantly intertwined.
Right. They were willing to compromise, even on something as profoundly moral as slavery, specifically to keep the Union intact. Kicking the can down the road, essentially.
Which makes you wonder if these men, with all their flaws and ambitions, could somehow broker those incredibly difficult deals. What lessons does their story hold for us today?
That's the vital question, isn't it? Their story really raises an important point for our own time, facing our own complex challenges and deep divisions. What can we learn from the great triumvirate's ambitions? Their willingness to compromise when the stakes felt highest, and their intense competition with each other. All within the framework of this fragile, but ultimately, so far, enduring republic.
Is compromise always the best path? Or, like you said, can it sometimes just defer an even greater reckoning down the line?
Exactly. Something worth thinking about.
It really is a powerful thought to chew on. You can really see how the individual choices these powerful figures made, for better or worse, shaped the destiny of a nation still finding its way. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.